From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's less than 2 weeks before North Carolina's first March primary, after years of going to the polls in May. What will this mean for the Tar Heel State's role in this presidential nominating process? New and historic wrinkles this year are part of the landscape: a federal court's ruling about illegal racial gerrymandering in North Carolina, and the first election in which voters must present a state-sanctioned ID. What will that mean for turnout this year? And are racist views that some argue were settled in the 1960s gaining traction on the national stage? With us today to take a crack at these and other political head-scratchers is the host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, a weekly political news magazine with plenty of bad jokes that we are proud to say now airs every Friday at 1 p.m. and Sunday at 4 p.m. here on WHQR. We're not only thrilled to welcome Ken Rudin to WHQR's programming lineup, we're over the moon that he is in Wilmington today for this special edition of Coastline. Ken Rudin, welcome to the program.
Rachel, I'm thrilled to be here, but bad jokes? I don't think they're bad jokes. I mean, some people might think they're bad jokes. I don't think they're bad jokes.
I think you identified them as bad jokes.
They are. They're terrible jokes.
This is publicly out there.
They're terrible jokes. But you know something? I think what I've always done, and I've loved politics for a long time, but I love to make politics entertaining as well as informative. I mean, some people are still so turned off to politics, and I suspect that more people than ever are turned off to politics, given the rancor that's out there. But at the same time, I think that people are fascinated as well. So I try to combine the lightness and the severity, and there is a lot of severity in politics.
There is, and we're watching that now on the national stage. I think it was Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who is a former Republican presidential candidate and hasn't really been much of a Trump supporter, said recently.
Well, you think he's not much of a Trump supporter?
He doesn't sound like he likes Donald Trump very much. Right. But he was talking, he even said that Trump's recent comment, you know, not disavowing David Duke and the KKK right away, all of these comments about Muslims and going back to the Mexicans.
Women.
Yes, and of course
and
women.
Handicapped.
And right. Yes, people with disabilities. Right. It's just he's managed to insult just about every group that there is, except white men. And yet Lindsey Graham says he's not a racist, that this is just he's using this as a political tool. In what landscape, on what planet was racism considered to be a pathway to political power?
Well,
is that what's happening?
If you ask Donald Trump's supporters, they'll say it's not racist and it's not about race. It's about dissatisfaction and anger and unease about what's happening in the country and what's happening in the world. We saw the attacks in Paris. We saw the homegrown attacks in San Bernardino. And people are just frightened. They're frightened that it seems like we're watching beheadings done in the name of ISIS across the world, around the world, and they see a President Obama unable or unwilling, depends on your point of view, to deal with this. Donald Trump, by magically saying that I can make this happen, I'll make this great again, I will do this, it'll be easy. I mean, the solutions are not concrete, they're not specific, but people are not looking for let me just remove my dentures and stuff. They're not looking for details. What they're looking for is just, you know, good sound bites, and Donald Trump is an expert on that.
So this is not an expression of latent racism that's just existed across the country and had
to me, when Donald Trump is asked about disavowing David Duke and support of white supremacists, it's not only David Duke. There are a lot of white supremacist groups out there who say David Duke makes the most sense. For him to say that I don't know who David Duke is not true. I mean, of course, he's talked about David Duke in the past when he was going to run for president in 2000 on the Reform Party. Donald Trump said, well, I don't want anything to do with the David Dukes and the Pat Buchanans and the white supremacists. So he clearly knows what he is. But he sends signals, a little wink or something to people out there that he just wants to, if if they're dissatisfied, they're angry. If they're dissatisfied, if they're angry, if they're furious with President Obama for X, Y, or Z reason, he wants their vote, and he was willing to say anything to get them and has been doing it. I mean, the perfect example is probably the most honest thing Donald Trump has ever said, and it was about, I don't know, maybe a month or two ago. He said, I can go to the center of middle of Fifth Avenue in Manhattan and shoot somebody, and my supporters will not desert me. And that's true. That's what we've seen. Every time we think he crosses a line or approaches a line or insults women or Muslims or Latinos or the disabled or whatever, or George W. Bush calling him a liar, every time we think he crosses a line, his numbers go up. It's happened every single time. And right now, I mean, for somebody who has covered politics as long as I have never, ever seen anything like it.
So you can't compare this to any particular time. We're looking at this giant rift in the Republican Party. Is the Republican Party about to be redefined?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we've seen rifts in the party before. We saw in 1964 when conservatives took over the party with Barry Goldwater. I wouldn't call it a hostile takeover, but it was they were tired of Me Too-ism. Eisenhower and Nixon were basically seen as Me Too kind of candidates, not really differentiating themselves much with the Democrats. Goldwater was different. Goldwater was very conservative. And while the conservatives jumped for joy in the 64 election, Goldwater lost 44 out of 50 states. It was a landslide defeat. And we think the Republican Party is gone forever. 2 years later, the Republicans picked up 47 seats in the House, and 2 years after that, Richard Nixon won the presidency. So every time we think, well, this is going to change things forever, the party is doomed forever, it's not as really as amazing or definitive as we think. 1972, George McGovern, the liberal, kicked out all the adults in the Democratic Party, took over the Democratic Party on an anti-war ticket and platform. He lost 49 states, and people saying, wow, the Democrats have finished forever. 2 years later came Watergate, when the Democrats won amazing victories, and 2 years after that was Jimmy Carter. So every time, the only reason I'm giving you this boring story, Rachel, is, by the way, since it's radio, not many people know this, Rachel fell asleep during that last speech I just gave you.
It's not true.
It's absolutely true. But, I mean, every time you think that things have changed forever, it somehow reverts. So, in other words, nothing is ever permanent in politics. Having said that, I have never seen a candidate who just says the things Donald Trump says and his support just goes up while the members of his party are pulling out their hair saying, how is this possible?
And that's what we're watching, the Republican establishment now saying, what are we going to do about this?
Well, it's kind of late for that, because I think they've been amused by Donald Trump all this time. They figured that maybe at most it's a diversion, it's a sideshow, it's fun, it's The Apprentice in real life, and therefore we don't have to worry about it. Now when he wins New Hampshire and South Carolina and Nevada and 7 of the 11 states on Super Tuesday, now you have the Mitt Romneys of the world saying, we've got to do something about that. Well, it sounds like the barn door is already closed, because right now his numbers are, he's leading in every upcoming poll. If the alternative is supposed to be Marco Rubio on March 15th, Donald Trump is leading in big in Florida. If the alternative is supposed to be John Kasich in Ohio on March 15th, Trump is leading in Ohio. So you could talk about, you know, we got to stop him. I don't know how you stop him, because, I mean, after all, this is a small D Democratic movement. And if the voters are saying we want Donald Trump, who is Mitt Romney and the Republican establishment, whatever the Republican establishment is, to stop them?
March 15th, by the way, is the date of North Carolina's own primary for the first time that
yes,
it's this early.
Well, actually, North Carolina has had early primaries. They've switched back and forth with Super Tuesday in the past, but of course, mostly it's a May primary, exactly right. But you're absolutely right. I mean, next March 15th is Ohio, it's North Carolina, it's Florida, and these are crucial states. But here's something also crucial. All these states are winner-take-all primaries. Starting March 15th, the Republicans. So if you have multi-candidate opposition to Donald Trump, and so you have three or four candidates in the race, Donald Trump doesn't need to win a majority. He could win 35, 40% of the vote. As long as he has one more vote than any other candidate, He gets all the delegates. So right now, the way the rules are written, the way the calendar looks, the way the demographics coming up look, it's I don't see how you stop him.
Is Donald Trump going to carry North Carolina, do you think?
Sure, why not? I mean, why not? I mean, look at what happened to Super Tuesday. He carried Georgia and Alabama and Virginia, and he carried Massachusetts and Vermont. So it's not a is it regional? You know, you think, well, maybe the David Duke thing is poo-pooed by voters in the South, but Massachusetts is certainly not, somebody, it doesn't seem like David Duke country to me, or Vermont, for goodness sakes. So I think, it's not because of what Donald Trump does. It's in spite of what Donald Trump does that the feeling is we're dissatisfied. Nothing is working. I mean, look what's going on. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, please.
I was just going to say, well, look what's going on on Capitol Hill. John Boehner, who by any stretch of the imagination is a conservative Republican, he battles with Barack Obama. Mitch McConnell spends his whole time saying, look, I want to defeat President Obama. And yet these guys, to many true believers, are sellouts. They've sold out conservative principles. John Boehner was ousted because he wasn't conservative enough. They said, wait a second, some voters said, if we elect Republicans in 2014 to control the Senate, control the House, then why do we still have Obamacare? Well, of course, the reason is because you have a guy named Obama in the White House. That's why you're not going to get rid of it. But they feel that these guys promised a change and they never saw it.
And I want to ask you about a brokered convention, a Republican brokered convention, if that's a possibility. But we're going to go to break, so we'll pick that up when we come back. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking with Ken Rudin, host of The Political Junkie, the newest addition to WHQR's programming lineup. You're listening to Coastline. We'll be back in 90 seconds. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're talking today with political junkie host Ken Rudin on this special edition of Coastline. And just before we went to break, Ken Rudin, we were getting into the Republican options in case Donald Trump does seem to walk away with the nomination, which it looks like is likely to happen at
so
this
far,
point.
Sure.
What are their options? A brokered convention, what is that and what would it look like?
Well, the definition of a brokered convention is somebody in either party coming to the convention without a majority of the delegates. In the old days, that used to happen all the time. In the old days, nominations were decided at the convention. Perfect example, as you well remember, Rachel, in 1952 at the Chicago convention, Adlai Stevenson walked into the convention as a non-candidate and walked out as a nominee. Basically, back then, that's how nominations were decided. The power brokers, the deals would be made to get nominations and nominees. Since the advent of the presidential primary system, which basically began in 1972, it's the primaries, it's the voters who decide who the nominees will be. And now that so many of these states are front-loaded, so they have them so early, that more and more candidates are wrapping up the nominations earlier than ever. So the political junkie fantasy is that a brokered convention, nobody gets to the convention with a majority of the delegates. But if the Republican Party, starting March 15th, is involved in winner-take-all primaries, then Donald Trump could really run up the score if he does well, as the polls indicate he will. So yes, it is great that so here's the thing. Nobody's going to come up to the convention and save the Republican Party from Donald Trump, because the rules say that those delegates picked in the primaries are bound and pledged to the candidate who wins his state, his or her state or district. So there can't be a rebellion against Trump by these delegates at the convention. The only way that these delegates are free to do what they want, if Trump doesn't get a majority at the convention, and then a lot of deal making could be done. But when you think of the Republican establishment, who is the Republican establishment anymore? I thought of this week, for example, when Mitt Romney called Donald Trump a fraud and a phony. Well, I mean, the Mitt Romney supporters have been saying that for months, but the Donald Trump supporters say, who cares? I mean, you're Mitt Romney, and you should have won the election in 2012, and you didn't. So who are you to tell us what to do? In the old days, a Jeb Bush would come in and rescue the party, theoretically, because Jeb Bush always had this great reputation of being a thinker and a Republican leader. Now all these emperors have no clothes because we've seen Donald Trump in every primary and every debate just eviscerate these Republicans, and they just look there's a very bizarre and surreal scene on Saturday Night Live where the fake Donald Trump told the fake Jeb Bush, he said, well, you pee sitting down. And then Jeb Bush says, no, I don't. And Trump says, yes, you do. And as ridiculous as that sounds, that is what the Republican debates have been like lately.
That's a pretty apt illustration of it. I mean, Marco Rubio recently talking about the size of Donald Trump's hands and the fact that he wanted a full-length mirror because his pants might be
wet. And of course, Donald Trump talking about Marco Rubio sweating and that he needs water and he's perspiring. And this is what we're talking about. I mean, once upon a time, I mean, I remember Lincoln versus Douglas. That was amazing. It was unbelievable. I saw it on cable. But now it's just lunacy.
Is the Republican establishment looking at a third party candidate?
Again, I don't even know what the Republican establishment means anymore, because if you look at the voters, I was looking at the New Hampshire electorate, and in 2012, you had Mitt Romney, who was a business conservative, you had Ron Paul, who was a libertarian, and you had John Huntsman, who was more of a moderate liberal Republican. All those precincts that those three candidates won in 2012 all went to Donald Trump in 2012. Every wing of the Republican Party seems to be the electorate seems to be backing Donald Trump. And of course, after two wings, I hang up. Yeah, okay, I thought I'd try that joke. But so I don't know what the establishment means anymore, but certainly there is the possibility, I would even say the likelihood, of a third party. I mean, we've seen third parties in the past. Mostly, they hurt the party. They hurt they don't get elected. I mean, think of Ross Perot in 1992. 19 million votes. He spent $60 million on his campaign, and he got zero electoral votes. But did he hurt President George H.W. Bush? Yes. When Ralph Nader ran for president in 2000, did he hurt Al Gore in Florida? Yes. When John Anderson ran for president in 1980, did he hurt his fellow liberal, somewhat liberal, Jimmy Carter? Yes. So these third-party candidates do hurt candidates more than get votes to themselves, but never have I ever seen a Republican Party so disenchanted with its likely nominee as I have this time.
And
I mean, even Barry Goldwater controlled the Republican Party in 64, and he wound up as a revered figure in the party. But this is really, really a hostile takeover, and everybody's flummoxed because they don't know what to do about it.
Does it mean, then, that a third-party candidate could actually be viable for the first time?
Well,
in many years.
Well, first of all, Michael Bloomberg has been talking the longest time about it, and he said he'd be willing to spend $1 billion. I mean, we need more New York billionaires in the race. I mean, just Donald Trump is not enough. We need more and more New York billionaires. But he says he would run. But here's the thing about Michael Bloomberg. He is very pro-choice. He is very pro-same-sex marriage. He is very pro-gun control. These are positions that Hillary Clinton takes. If Bloomberg, because he's so outraged by Donald Trump to run as a third-party candidate, if anything, he could hurt Hillary Clinton. Having said that, if there was a Republican third-party candidate, and of course, you have to have a lot of money. You have to be on the ballot in all 50 states. It takes a lot of organizing, a lot of money to do that. That's why Perot is one of the few to be able to do it, because it's so expensive. If there is some Republican effort to do that, then maybe there are some Republicans who would rather lose with Trump, I mean, rather hurt the Republican Party in the short run in 2016 than let Donald Trump win the presidency. And he could do that. You know, in 19... Oh, you're falling asleep again. But anyway, In 1980, the Democrats said, if only we could run against Ronald Reagan, because they thought he was an actor, he was too extreme, he was, you know, way out there. If only, I mean, Reagan would be the perfect guy. Be careful what you wish for, because Reagan was a very good, solid, articulate, attractive candidate, and he basically, you know, wiped the floor with Jimmy Carter winning 44 states or thereabouts against an incumbent president. So you're gonna need somebody like that who can do it. But right now, I don't know if Donald Trump will, as a candidate, will bring out a very large African American, female, Latino vote in opposition to him, or he'll bring out new voters who adore him to bring voters who are never into the in the political system to begin with. To predict, in other words, to predict what's going to happen as Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton is there's no way of predicting because you don't know what's going to happen.
So his supporters then are not necessarily Republican establishment supporters.
Oh, they're definitely not Republican establishment.
He's not a fiscal conservative. He's not a social conservative.
Well, he is in some way. I mean, if you think that closing the border is a conservative, but at the same time he is pro-life. But he used to be pro-choice. He's giving money to Republicans, but he gave money to Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton. His whole career is contradictions. But I don't think anybody cares. I don't think people care if he supports the free trade treaty in the Far East. I don't think anybody cares. I think they just feel that we want somebody who will get something done. He pledges to get something done, and voters say, keep going. It's remarkable.
Looking at the March 15th primary that's less than 2 weeks away here in North Carolina, what role is North Carolina going to play, do you think? Is this a significant state or not so much when it comes to choosing the presidential nominees?
Well, the thing about North Carolina, in November, it's probably one of the top five, six states that are crucial. Of course, as long as we have an electoral college that decides the presidency, North Carolina is one among a handful of states, Ohio, Florida, Virginia, Nevada, New Hampshire, Iowa, that are key swing states that nobody knows what's going to happen. Remember, Barack Obama carried North Carolina in 2008. Mitt Romney carried in 2012, one of the few states, I think two or three states in the country, that switched in those two cycles. But in the primary, when all attention is going to be basically on the viability of Marco Rubio, who comes from Florida, and John Kasich, who comes from Ohio, I suspect that most of the attention on the Republican side on March 15th will be in the Ohio and Florida primaries, less so in North Carolina. On the Democratic side, and we haven't even talked about the Democrats yet, there was a sizable African-American population that we've seen so far, starting in South Carolina, continuing through Super Tuesday, that is overwhelming for Hillary Clinton. It's remarkable because 8 years ago in South Carolina, the tactics used by her husband, Bill Clinton, aimed at the black community was just, I mean, it was just split the black vote, and there was a lot of anger coming out of the black community because
it really backfired.
Oh, it sure did backfire. But she became Obama's loyal Secretary of State. She pledges that her candidacy will be, in a sense, a third Obama term. And we always, you know, the joke has always been that Bill Clinton was really the first black president in this country because of the way growing up in the South, speaking that kind of language. So I think North Carolina, it's not the kind of state that Bernie Sanders wants to face after a big defeat on Super Tuesday. And that's why he's going to be looking at the industrial Midwest, the Illinois of the world, the Ohio's, Missouri's, because his argument for income inequality and economic populism play better in the industrial Midwest than it does in the black community.
By next week, Bernie Sanders will have opened up five offices in the state of North Carolina. Is that sort of a paltry number of bases, or is that significant?
Well, it just shows that, I mean, look, he said on Super Tuesday that he's going all the way to the convention, and every candidate has to say that. You don't want to hem and haw about that because he's still, there are a lot of people excited about Bernie Sanders. He's still raising a ton of money. There are a lot of people who believe in him. There are a lot of Democrats, and of course Republicans, but a lot of Democrats who don't completely feel comfortable about Hillary Clinton as the nominee. I mean, we always talk about Donald Trump's net negativity in the polls, and the latest NBC poll had him with a negativity of 57%. But Hillary Clinton's negativity is 50%. She has more disapproval than approval in the ratings in a lot of polls. So while is she the inevitable nominee? I hate to say anything is inevitable because it's impossible to predict because everything has been so topsy-turvy. But right now, if you asked me, do I think she's a nominee? I do. I've always thought that. There were some speed bumps early with Benghazi and the emails and the way she would answer certain questions. But the fact that Bernie Sanders is still looking at North Carolina, spending money in North Carolina, shows that he's not giving anything up. But I really don't think that should be one of his top targets. But Massachusetts was one of his top targets, and he lost that. So I think right now, you no longer have the option of picking and choosing. You just got to go for it, and you have the money to do it.
And not so long ago, people were saying if Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump turned out to be the nominees, then it's a pretty clear path for Hillary Clinton to the White House. Is that still true?
Oh, no, I don't think so. Again, it goes back to the be careful of what you wish for. As I said earlier, Democrats said, with Ronald Reagan, there's no way we're going to lose in 1980. I mean, Jimmy Carter is a shoo-in for another term because Ronald Reagan is so extreme. I think there are a lot of Democrats who say, give me Donald Trump because he'll bring back a backlash of women and Latinos and minorities and the young and all that stuff. But others say he is attracting voters who many of them are from Earth. I understand that. But many of them are really just angry. And look at the turnout we've seen in the primaries so far. Gigantic record turnouts on the Republican side, much smaller turnouts on the Democratic side. That frightens Democratic strategists because they know that Trump is bringing in new voters and voters who may never have voted before. And to say that, we have this in the bag in November, that's not the case. Now, it's very possible that Trump on the ticket could endanger a lot of vulnerable Republican senators and a lot of, in center states like in Illinois and Ohio and Wisconsin, those senators are in New Hampshire. There are a lot of Republican senators who would rather not Donald Trump be on the top of the ticket. But counting out Trump and his loyal followers in November, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't bet on it.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Political Junkie host Ken Rudin on this special edition of Coastline. The Political Junkie has just joined WHQR's programming lineup. Tune in here on 91.3 FM at Fridays at 1 o'clock and Sundays at 4 o'clock. This is going to be the first election North Carolina has had a voter ID law in place. What kind of impact do you think that will have on turnout?
That's a great question. I know people. I mean, I know it's a very volatile issue. It's a very emotional issue. There are a lot of people with some justification of saying that this is aimed at the black and the elderly and the minority community. At the same time, people look at what happened in 2014 in North Carolina when Tom Tillis was elected to the Senate, and of course the ID law wasn't instituted yet. But all these arguments about suppressing the black vote, there are some people who say that ultimately it's overblown. I mean, I know that's not politically correct to say anymore because look, if you believe in democracy, if you believe in the right to vote, there should not be roadblocks. And do I think that certain legislatures put up certain things to hamper the African-American community from coming out? I do. I think the argument that vote fraud is rampant, I don't buy that for a second. But I do think at the same time, I don't know if it's affected that much of a turnout. There are other states that have voter ID laws. I don't know if it's going to happen this year. It may have an effect, though. It'll be interesting to watch in the gubernatorial race because the current governor, Pat McCrory, is probably the most vulnerable governor in the country. North Carolina, I mean, the Richard Burr Senate race, very few people are paying attention to.
That's considered still a safe Republican seat.
Pretty much comfortable. I mean, nothing is safe because the top of the ticket will matter, I think, in North Carolina. Depends on what kind of a turnout you get from the top of the ticket. But this race, McCrory versus Cooper, assuming that's going to be the result of the March 15th primary, is the top governor's race in the country. Very close. North Carolina does not. I think the last time it defeated an incumbent governor, I think it was 1066. I think it was William the Conqueror was defeated. Had a tough year that year. Didn't have. But this is a race to watch, and it's interesting because I'm not sure if it's criticism about McCrory or more importantly, whether the state legislature has gone too far with trying to implement its agenda. Tom Tillis had a bit of that problem in 2014. And I think McCrory is not only battling Democrats, but he's battling some of his more conservative Republicans as well. He's in a tough battle. He's in a tough race.
He's had a fairly contentious relationship both chambers, more with the Senate, which is the more conservative chamber in the state legislature.
He has, because I think the part of it is that he comes from a more of a business wing of the Republican Party. And I think many of the legislature are more rural, more conservative, more Tea Party-ish, more interested in social issues than business solutions. And that's that conflict we see in the Republican Party in many states around the country, especially you see it in North Carolina.
So the congressional districts, this federal court just last month said you have to redraw two congressional districts here in North Carolina because they've been racially gerrymandered and they're unconstitutional districts. Those have been redrawn. It's still an open question as to whether those will be approved.
You know something? I'm smiling as you're saying this, Rachel, because when this, I'm thinking of the former Mel Watt district, that weird zigzag of a district in the middle of the state. When that district was first written and drawn up in 1991, it was done with the absolute approval of the African American community. It was the first time they had a chance to elect a black congressman. Was it racially gerrymandered? Yes, but so what? It's the only way that could have been a black congressman elected in North Carolina. So Democrats were thrilled, African Americans were thrilled. Mel Watt gets elected to Congress in 1992. The problem, of course, and that Democrats are learning to their regret, is that by stuffing these districts with every black voter you can find, you're basically protecting and leaving the outlying districts more white than ever, and it makes the Republican chances of retaining those seats even more secure than it had been. So, yes, these kind of racially drawn lines did elect black congressmen in 92 and then subsequently, but ultimately it hurts the Democratic Party.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Ken Rudin, host of The Political Junkie, is here. We'll be back in 90 seconds. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're talking today with political junkie Ken Rudin, whose eponymous show has just joined the WHQR lineup. You can hear Ken Rudin's Political Junkie here on 91.3 FM every Friday at 1 o'clock and every Sunday at 4 o'clock. Ken Rudin, just before we went to break, you were talking about the history of gerrymandering in North Carolina and how Democrats were very happy with how that went. Was it the last time around?
No, this was the 92.
1992.
Basically, if you looked at the number of African Americans in Congress, in the House, in 1992 compared to 1994, it was just remarkably different. Many districts were created out of just redrawing the lines. But you also realize that it also hurt white Democrats in the South. And that's why if you look at what the House looks like now, it's mostly a black Southern Party and a white rest of the country party, because so many of the districts that were drawn to elect African Americans helped the Republicans in the surrounding districts. And so, you know, I mean, you could make the argument that Mel Watt and so many, I'm trying to think of some other members of Congress from North Carolina.
Who was the woman in the first district? We'll have to get past that. Okay.
I'm just thinking of all the African Americans who've been elected to Congress starting in 1992. But at the same time, North Carolina has gotten a majority of Republican House members, which not only does it never had before, but when you look at the redistricting around the country, more votes have been cast for Democratic House candidates in North Carolina, and yet I think the margin in the House is 9 Republicans and 4 Democrats because of this redistricting. So it's funny, for the longest time, Democrats drew all the lines, and there was no, and North Carolina never had, I mean, they didn't have a—I think the first Republican ever elected governor was Jim Holzhauser in 1972. So they never—there was no such thing as Republican power in North Carolina. Once the Republicans started gaining congressional districts and legislative districts, the whole state has turned around, and now it's considered, aside from the presidency, which is even pretty much even, a leaning Republican state, which is anybody who has studied Southern politics, it's just remarkable to see what's happened in South Carolina, North Carolina, Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama. These states never elected Republicans, ever. And now it's very rare that a Democrat can win statewide in any of those states.
Just in the last 4 years, we've watched this trend from a purple state to, isn't it a decidedly red state now?
Not in presidential elections, though. I still think it's leaning Republican. Of course, the fact that Barack Obama won in 2008 reminds us that there is a significant African-American population here that, you know, that will come out and vote for a Democratic candidate. But for the most part, it felt like 2012 was almost the state returning to normal. It's still, again, considered a swing state. Matter of fact, the word on 2012 is it's the only swing state that Mitt Romney carried in 2012. Every other one, Florida, Ohio, Virginia, Iowa, Nevada, all went for the Democrats and Barack Obama.
Do you vote?
I don't vote in primaries. I live in Maryland. And matter of fact, even I think it almost feels like even if I said I was an independent, that sounds like a party to me. In Maryland, it's called a non-affiliated voter. I am a non-affiliated voter. In my heart of hearts, look, every journalist loves to say, oh, I'm definitely non-biased. I'm really, you know, fair and balanced, to quote my friends at Fox. But I see good and bad. I see pluses and minuses in both parties. Even the abortion issue or the war issue. I see the arguments on both sides. What disturbs, so I don't vote in, I never vote in primaries. I do vote in November. There's no rhyme or reason. Sometimes I just like a candidate because of X, Y, or Z. Sometimes it's personality driven. I mean, I know the argument for George W. Bush in 2000 was you can have a beer with him or go bowling with him, unlike Al Gore. That's not how I vote, but I understand that people do vote on personality and stuff like that. But, you know, let me just say something. Here I am yakking away nonstop, and, you know, Rachel falls asleep every few seconds, which is sad. But here's the thing, though. I've seen demagogues before. I've seen rabble-rousers. I've seen unsavory campaign tactics in the past. And I've never cast judgment. But I find myself, and this disappoints me about myself, I find myself watching Donald Trump, the lack of decency, the lack of civility. And not that politics is a friendly game. It should be rough and tumble. But there's a lack of decency that I find it's bringing out the worst in me because I'm reacting with such frustration. And I've never seen it before, and it disappoints me.
You recently have said things like, this is a political campaign, and I think you were talking about the Republican presidential race, that had heat but very little light. And how do you find that balance between talking about what you're observing in a race like that and letting your own political colors show?
Look, I don't know how to answer that question other than the fact that in my heart of hearts, and people could say, oh, you're full of, you know, baloney because I've listened to you and you said X, Y, or Z. I don't think I have political colors. I look at politics not like I look at baseball, like a sport, but I look at it, I see the arguments. I see, you know, I mean, abortion is a perfect example. Like, you're either pro-choice or pro-life, but no, why? Why should you be either or?
You think it's a more nuanced discussion than that?
I think there's a lot of gray. Everything is not black and white. I've seen that in every campaign I've ever seen. The pluses of Reagan, the minuses of Reagan, the pluses of Jimmy Carter, the minuses of Jimmy Carter.
So you started out this way. Have your politics changed since you started reporting when you started your career versus now? Have you become more tolerant?
No, I've become less tolerant, which again is a big regret on my part because
less tolerant of what?
the rancor, the rhetoric, the lack of decency, the contempt that one candidate whose name I won't mention because I don't want to talk about Donald Trump, but the contempt that they have for norms. You just to say the things you say about women and Latinos and Muslims and again the handicapped and just, you know, I think many Republicans are making a mistake by saying, well, Donald Trump is not a real conservative. That's why he should be defeated. That's not my argument against Donald Trump. I have no problem with conservative Republicans or liberal Democrats. I just care about the lack of civility, the lack of decency that is just and what goes on in some of the rallies when reporters are pulled out or you'll have African Americans just standing there and they'll be just pushed out of a rally because they're standing there because they are who they are and they're not doing anything disruptive. They just
is this something that has been have we been moving towards this with the vitriol on Capitol Hill over the last few years?
That's a great question.
At what point did it change?
Well, that's a great question. That's a great question because, I mean, you could always, what I always say is like, I remember Justice Scalia, who died recently, when he was confirmed to the Supreme Court, it was 98-0. And this guy is a pretty hardcore conservative, 98-0. Now, there's reasons why he didn't get opposition because he was up the same year Rehnquist was up. But having said that, in 1987, the following year, Robert Bork was defeated for the Supreme Court by the Democrats. In 1989, John Tower who was President Bush's, he was a former senator from Texas. He was nominated for Secretary of Defense, was defeated by the Democrats. Then a few years later, the Republicans went after Speaker Jim Wright in the House. It seems like there's been a tit for tat. And then you see Democrats and Republicans refusing to confirm judges, which never happened before. It started with Clinton. It got much, much worse with George W. Bush. It got unbelievably worse with Barack Obama to the point where Barack Obama could nominate, you know, Ronald Reagan for the Supreme Court, and the Republicans will say no. It's just gotten worse and worse. In the old days, even though Republicans and Democrats didn't like each other, they still would, after the battles on the House floor, they would go back to the office and open up a drawer and a bottle of bourbon would come out and they would just drink their way to happiness. Now this, if you're a Democrat and you talk to a Republican, you're a traitor. If you're a Republican talking to a Democrat, you're for amnesty. There's no compromise anymore. There's no civility anymore. And of course, if you are a Republican and start to be friends with Democrats, you're challenged by the right wing of your party in a primary. If you're a Democrat who, like Joe Lieberman, who wants to work with the Republicans, you're challenged by the left wing of the party in a primary. So right now, once upon a time, politicians used to care about satisfying the middle, the undecided middle, the centrist voters. That's out the window. Now it's all about satisfying your base.
So then does Donald Trump represent someone that could finally reach across the aisle because he doesn't have any of those party allegiances?
Wow, that's a great question. And actually, he says yes, because he's a businessman. So of course I've given to Nancy Pelosi. Of course I've given to Harry Reid. But you also have a guy who says that, you know, Vladimir Putin is a friend and George W. Bush is a liar. I mean, the people he likes and the people he doesn't like. Look.
You were offended that he called Marco Rubio a lightweight.
I wasn't offended. But here's what it is. This is Super Tuesday. He, not that he should be magnanimous or gracious, but he's a big winner on Super Tuesday. The path to the nomination is his. He seems to have a clear path in the upcoming states. Why ridicule Marco Rubio on your victory speech? I mean, sometimes I think he just can't help it. But why do that? I mean, what do you get out of it? If you want the party to unite behind you in November, why mock? You know, he would do he would make fun of George of Jeb Bush. He would remember the time when he read out loud Lindsey Graham's cell phone number. I mean, he would just do things to get under the skin of all these other Republicans. Why do it? I mean, you've come this far. You're clearly on the path to the nomination. Why just not say that, you know, congratulations to my opponents, but we're on the path to the nomination. Why do it on a victory speech? So I wasn't offended. I wasn't disappointed because that sounds like I was surprised. I just wish there was some more. Well, again, if having said what I'm listening to what I'm saying because. One, nobody else's, and two, I'm sorry, but people.
I'm on the edge of my seat here.
but people say, well, you know, I mean, this is what politics is. I mean, why should you be upset about Donald Trump when look what the establishment has been doing all these years? I mean, we have the endless wars, and we have the deficits, and we have everything going wrong in the country, and lack of respect, and. Why not have somebody who stands up for and doesn't care about what the repercussions are?
And this is clearly the tack that he's taking and that is propelling him in the polls.
Right.
That's appealing
right.
to his base,
absolutely.
Whoever that is.
Right. Well, the base.
So what does
right.
that say about America at this point?
I always think of when Colin Powell went to the UN to make the case for that there were weapons of mass destruction. It's right to go topple Saddam Hussein. A lot of people said, why isn't the media calling him out? Why isn't the media doing a better job investigating what the truth is about the war in Iraq, for better or worse? The media are, I don't mean to be anti-Semitic, but the media are talking about all the things that Donald Trump has done, his contradictions, his just flat out mistruths, untruths. And yet nobody seems to care. So.
Nobody does care. And we do have a clip of this recent CNN debate that was between two commentators, Van Jones and Jeffrey Lord.
Yeah, I watched
and
that.
They were talking about the fact of Donald Trump's refusal to initially completely disavow David Duke and the Ku Klux Klan. Let's listen to just part of that.
And you guys play these word games, and it's wrong to do in America.
It is wrong to understand that these are not leftists. They were a
What difference does it make if
it
you call them
a
leftists?
Lot of difference,
they
Van.
Call
we're
them chipmunks. They
Van,
kill people.
We're not,
and you don't play games with that.
And you don't hide and say that's not part of the base of the Democratic Party. That has been, they were the military arm, the terrorist arm of the Democratic Party, according to historians.
That's
for God's sakes, read your history.
I don't know. But I don't care.
This whole attitude of dividing by race is still here. And this is
I
how Democrats do the deal.
How they voted 50 years ago.
Ken Rudin, what do you make of Jeffrey Lord's point that the KKK base was historically a sector of the Democratic Party? That's an interesting argument.
Yeah, of course it was. I mean, everybody knows that because the Republican Party never existed in the South back in the 1920s or even in Indiana where the Klan expanded. We know the history of the Klan, but that's like saying that the Republicans, you know, the African-Americans vote Republican because of Abraham Lincoln. I mean, that was a long time ago. Yes, that's true. The Democratic Party was the party of the Klan. But the point is, one, I mean, again, I don't want to make one party racist or not racist, but with Jeffrey Lord, who's a Donald Trump supporter, said on CNN that basically he equated David Duke and the Klan with Reverend Wright, who was a supporter of President Obama. And Van Jones said, wait a second, I don't remember Reverend Wright lynching people. I don't remember them burning crosses. I mean, so the use of history is always subjective, and also you always want to use history to make your point, whether it's factual or not. But to watch that debate, and I sat there with my mouth open for 15 minutes, and I mean it was amazing and enthralling TV. It just showed why there's a certain segment of the population that is not listening to the other at all, because some of the arguments that were made in that back and forth were just ludicrous. But it seemed like it was not too dissimilar to what are some of the things I see in the actual debate among candidates.
We just have a few seconds left. North Carolina is going to go for Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton.
That's my guess. I mean, I don't see any reason why that's not the case. It will not get the attention it deserves because of the Ohio's with Kasich and Florida and Rubio, but yeah.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Ken Rudin, thank you so much for joining us today.
I still have more to talk about. Can I still talk? When we go off the air,
we can do this off mic.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. Ken Rudin's Political Junkie Show airs here on WHQR 91.3 FM, Fridays at 1 and Sundays at 4. Join us next Wednesday on Coastline for our Political Reporters Roundtable. We're joined by WECT's John Evans and Tim Buckland of the Star News. That's Wednesday, March 9th at 12:06. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callis. Allison, our producer, is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. If you missed part of today's show, look for it on our website at whqr.org or subscribe to the podcast from the iTunes store. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.